Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day.
Kim Jong-un must be removed from power by Governor John R. Kasich. As news reports surface of yet another missile test by North Korea, the United States must consider increased pressure on the regime of Kim Jong-un. These threats are not new to our nation and they aren't going away. Having served 9 terms in Congress, including 18 years on the House Armed Services Committee, I remember facing similar threats in 1994 when North Korea refused to let international inspectors in to see facilities where it extracted nuclear material for use in weapons. By every estimate, North Korea's facilities could have been destroyed safely back then, with no loss of life for South Korea or for us. But there was a chance that they would retaliate and use conventional means, primarily artillery hidden in North Korea's mountains, against the people of South Korea. According to news reports 5 years later, the Pentagon predicted at the time that as many as 1 million South Korean lives could be lost. William Perry, U.S. Secretary of Defense in 1994, later wrote that such estimates had persuaded him to recommend against a military strike. As we have waded through the years since that provocation, the more difficult problems with North Korea have become. Military solutions were difficult then, but are even more difficult today. While we all have hoped that the situation would settle down and we wouldn't have to resort to a direct military attack that could threaten the lives of millions of people in Seoul, the fact of the matter is that North Korea's nuclear program only continues to get stronger. It has conducted 5 nuclear tests underground. It has reportedly extracted sufficient materials for dozens of nuclear weapons, developed preliminary capabilities to miniaturize such weapons for missiles, and demonstrated rocket engines necessary for long-range missile delivery systems. Much has changed in the past quarter century. Yet many commentators speak of the North Korean threat to Seoul's civilian population as though it precludes any American military action against the North. We thus witness an odd ongoing debate, in which many cite North Korea's rapid advancements but believe American policy should remain stuck in a time warp, frozen by its same limitations of 1994. Some policy experts assert that the danger to our allies in Seoul precludes American military action and proves that our options are limited to financial sanctions against the pariah state, or perhaps to negotiating a package of benefits that will only guarantee the regime emerges more powerful from each crisis it creates. These are not objectives, but are stalling tactics, and as we have seen in the past 2.5 decades, the North Korean regime uses time to develop still more threatening capabilities. This just kicks the can down the road. But time has not stood still for us either, and we have learned much about the power structure in North Korea, especially with the rise of the murderous grandson of the Kim family dynasty, an empire that has been in place since the end of the Korean War in the early 1950s. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is right that all options need to be on the table. I strongly believe this should include a regime change and the removal of Kim Jong-un and his immediate Pyongyang inner circle. Without Kim in power, North Korea would collapse in indecision, and the possibilities of peace in the region would be immediately enhanced.
The Ridiculously Easy Way to Boost Your Metabolism by Amanda McMillan. If you keep your home at a comfortable 70 degrees year-round, you might want to switch it up a bit. Fluctuating indoor temperatures are good for your metabolism, suggests a new scientific report, and may even be an important way to fight obesity and diabetes. The authors don't suggest dramatic changes in comfort level, but they do say that exposure to mildly cold and warm environments may have real health benefits. Their paper, published in Building Research and Information, highlights several findings that support their theory. In 2015, for example, the researchers found that diabetics who were exposed to 10 days of intermittent cold, 59 degrees for a total of 6 hours a day, saw their insulin sensitivity increase by more than 40%. This is comparable with the best available pharmaceutical or physical activity therapies, the authors wrote. Several studies have also suggested that exposure to heat or cold can have effects, both positive and negative, on cardiovascular processes, including blood pressure and heart rate, as well as the immune system. A variation in temperature trains the body's vascular system, says lead author Wouter van Marken Lichtenveld, PhD, professor of ecological energetics and health at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, sending warm blood to the skin and cold blood to the core of the body, for example. Research has also shown that cold temperatures trigger an increase in calorie-burning brown fat and improve muscle cells' ability to take up glucose or energy. Van Mark in Lichtenbelt says it's not yet clear whether it's the change from warm to cold or simply the cold itself that's responsible for these benefits. The authors argue that temperatures in modern homes and offices should be dynamic, and that building professionals should take this research into account when designing and managing living spaces and workplaces. Individuals can make use of these findings as well, Van Mark in Lichtenbelt told Health.com via email. He can't recommend specific timing or temperatures just yet, but says that people should strive for a mild variation, not always, all day and every season, at the same temperature. In other words, make your home and office mimic the outdoors, with natural ups and downs from day to day and month to month. Think opening the windows instead of cranking up the AC, or dialing down your thermostat a few degrees on cold winter days. In addition to potential health perks, he says, adjustments like these might also save money and energy. Van Mark in Lichtenbelt and his team plan to further study insulin sensitivity in people with diabetes to determine an optimal protocol for temperature variations. Such variations may have potential not just for improving the health of diabetics, he says, but as a preventative measure against the disease as well. They're not the only ones investigating the link between temperature and insulin sensitivity. A study published last month in BMJ Open Diabetes Research and Care suggested that climate change and a warming planet might play a role in the increase of diabetes cases worldwide. Before the researchers can say anything for certain, though, they need more definitive findings and more research on different populations, like healthy people and the elderly. I feel that we have gathered enough data to state that the environmental temperature matters, says Van Mark in Lichtenbelt, but we still have to prove long-term effects. The authors also make it clear that adjusting your home temperature is by no means a quick fix for obesity and its related health problems. This practice should go hand in hand with methods that are known to work, they say, like a healthy diet and regular exercise. How This 29-Year-Old Makes a Living as a Professional Bridesmaid by Kristen Baller. You can't call up a professional bridesmaid, a.k.a. the world's first bridesmaid for hire, a.k.a. your wedding wingwoman, without digging for some dirt. Jen Glantz, a 29-year-old Manhattanite with the militant positivity of a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, has spent 3 years tagging out frazzled, distracted, and otherwise incapacitated bridesmaids. Naturally, she's got the best, worst, bridezilla stories. There was one August wedding where I found the bride downing a bottle of vodka, Glantz recalls. She got blackout drunk and started screaming that it was the worst night of her life. Glantz is just getting started. She's seen women ask their bridesmaids to dye their hair, to get a spray tan, to lose weight. She's seen brides ruin their own would-be cookie-cutter wedding because it wasn't a carbon copy of the Pinterest board they'd meticulously created. She's seen brides break down minutes before walking down the aisle because they realize the man they're about to marry is, in fact, the worst. But she gets it. The pressure that comes with turning a dream wedding into a reality can crush the most even-keeled bride, she says. Glantz is the release valve. Friends don't know how to handle brides in stressful wedding situations, she says. It becomes a bit of a nightmare. I'm that third-party person who can say, you can chill about this because you can trust me. I bring them back to reality. The moment she said I do to bridesmaiding. A Florida native who moved to New York after college, Glantz took 6 unpaid trips down the aisle before realizing her perky put-together vibe, that bridal party je ne sais quoi, could be easily monetized. In 2014, she posted an ad in Craigslist's personal section, Women for Women, for brides who need someone to take control, and got over 100 responses in 2 days. Since then, Glantz has become something of a bridesmaid's guru. She writes about weddings for Brides magazine, Refinery 29, and Pop Sugar, and has given bridal tips to numerous publications. Fresh off a tour for her new book, Always a Bridesmaid, for hire, Glantz's business is thriving. At the beginning of April, she had 20 clients lined up for the spring wedding season, and the rest of her calendar is quickly filling up. Every month is wedding season for me, she says. The prenup. For $1,200 to $2,000, brides can hire Glantz as a day-of coordinator, a wedding planner light who makes sure everything from picking up the dry cleaning to tossing the bouquet runs smoothly. Other brides pay glance to literally walk down the aisle and stand next to them at the altar, often as a replacement for a friend they've had a falling out with, or who has otherwise abandoned the sacred duties of bridesmaiding. It happens more than you think, Glantz says. The starting price for that service is $2,000. Some of Glantz's clients aren't brides at all. The Help I'm a Maid of Honor package, which includes a Skype session with Glantz and a custom month-by-month to-do list, starts at $350. Speech writing is an extra $175. The cheapest package? A set of tutorial videos on how to be a bridesmaid, for $35. You complete me. Glantz is in the business of managing expectations. Usually that means oscillating between the bride's temporary best friend, therapist, and voice of reason. All of that she can handle with ease. The bigger challenge, she says, is keeping incognito. Most brides don't want anyone to know they've paid a stranger thousands of dollars to be in their wedding, so Glantz has to make up a backstory with a fake name and vague connection to the bride to explain how they know each other. That can look suspicious, particularly when Glantz is called in to, say, replace a maid of honor. But Glantz says the other bridesmaids usually warm to her pretty quickly. They're happy I'm doing all the dirty work, she says, because every wedding has a ton of drama. David McCullough, President Trump's Disregard for History is Utter Nonsense, by Olivia B. Waxman. Over the course of nearly 50 years, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough has traveled across the U.S. speaking to audiences at universities, the White House, and even before a joint session of Congress, about the lessons of history. Some of his most recent speeches were compiled in his new book, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For, out Tuesday. McCullough sat down with Time to talk about why he's publishing this anthology now, how history will judge us, and what the past can teach our presidents. Time. Why compile your speeches now? McCullough. I felt it necessary. The time was right. We began work last summer as the campaign got more off track. We have to remind ourselves of what we believe in the way of standard behavior, standard dedication, standard patriotism. And in order to do that, you have to understand history. We've been raising several generations of young Americans who are, by and large, historically illiterate. And it's not that they're not bright. It's not that they're indifferent to learning. It's not that they've grown up with great disadvantages. It's not their fault. It's our fault. Almost 80% of colleges and universities no longer require history for graduation. What should history classes focus on to be the most useful in today's world? History is about people. History is about cause and effect. History is about leadership or lack thereof, or twisted vision that inflicts its mistakes upon leaders. As I point out in the book, the best of our presidents, using the presidency as a model of leadership, were all avid readers of history. Several of them were historians. Woodrow Wilson was professionally a professor at Princeton. Theodore Roosevelt wrote one of the best histories of the Naval War of 1812. John Kennedy wrote three works of history, one of which, Profiles in Courage, is still a very good book. Dwight Eisenhower wrote one of the best books ever written on World War II, and he wrote every word himself. Even if you do nothing, it has an effect. It isn't just that the effect comes from action, it can come from inaction. Some of the best decisions ever made by our presidents are when they decided not to do something. Harry Truman decided he would not use the atomic bomb in Korea. General Eisenhower decided not to go into Vietnam. John Adams decided not to go to war with France when it would have been disastrous, and it made him very unpopular. So when you take that job, you have to not only understand how the government works, but you have to understand how human beings work, and that people are imperfect. We're so inclined to portray the heroes of the Revolutionary War era as all perfect. No, they weren't perfect. How can we judge that? Should we use today's standards to assess those leaders, or just the standards of the time in which they lived? First, you have to understand the time in which they lived. There was no simpler time, ever. There was no easier time, ever. Unless you understand what it was like to go through the Civil War, what the influenza epidemic of 1918 was like, you have no appreciation of that. History is an antidote to the hubris of the present. History should be a lesson that produces immense gratitude for all those who went before us. To be ignorant of their contribution is rude, And for anyone in public life to brag about how they don't know any history and don't care to know any history is irresponsible.
President Trump has expressed admiration for Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay, Douglas MacArthur, and George Patton. What does that say about the type of leader he aspires to be? He said he does not read history or presidential biographies because, as he said, he has a mind that can reach beyond all that. That's utter nonsense. That's egocentric illusion. To me, it's as if we've put someone in the pilot seat who has never flown a plane or even read about how you do it. So we have to cope with it by counteracting that with young people coming along that realize that this is a lesson in how not to be a leader. Is he the reason you wrote this book? Yes, but let me stress, I never mention his name in the book. I'm talking to all Americans. I'm talking as much to the people who voted for him as much as the people who voted against him. Let's get this momentary spasm we're going through over with as soon as possible and out of our minds. We have to try to figure out how to get back on track. Do you think America is truly exceptional? Should students be taught that? I think America has come further in giving opportunity to the best that's in human nature than any other country ever in history, and we seem to be holding on for over 200 years already. We've greatly improved the inequalities and the shortcomings of our way of life as we've moved forward. One of the things I feel is that we are a country of good people. We are a country of well-meaning, hard-working, conscientious people, 90% of us. And we are blessed with progress in a number of fields today, the likes of which no people on earth have ever enjoyed in all of history. Think, just for example, of what's happened in medicine. Think of the improvements that have been made and the opportunity for education. We have the strongest, most powerful, well-equipped military force in the world. I am optimistic. I don't think we should feel, because we've got this clown holding stage, that that's what we're destined to do from now on. What name should historians give this period of history we're living in? It's not my profession to judge things now. You've got to wait 50 years. But I'm sure they will wonder what in the world overcame us. You were on the first board of scholars for the new Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, which opens this week. What are its most valuable artifacts, in your opinion, the ones that people should make sure to see? I don't think the artifacts are the most important. So what is important about the museum's collection? What's so important about it is it's the first museum on the subject of the American Revolution that we've ever had. And underline this, we can never know enough about the American Revolution if we want to understand who we are, why we are the way we are, and why we've accomplished what we've been able to accomplish that no other country has. What do you think future historians will think of the material that we'll leave them from today? We're producing so much for future historians that they may be just overwhelmed because so much of it is redundant and boring. There's a record of everything, every day. Facebook, for God's sake. It's like a landslide every day of stuff. So the fact that we're not writing letters to each other won't hurt them? Oh, that's a huge loss, because no one in public life would dare keep a diary anymore. It could be subpoenaed and used against you in court. And nobody writes letters. If you're interested in immortality, start keeping a diary. And when you get to the point when you think maybe the curtain is going to come down on you, give it to the Library of Congress, and you'll be quoted forever because it will be the only diary ever in existence. Is there a particular biography you wish you had written or would like to see a historian write? Some figure who you think is ripe for exploration? I think there's a good biography to be written about Gerald Ford. He was a far more interesting figure of depth as a leader than he's given credit for. What's your favorite historical monument or museum in the U.S. or abroad? The Shaw Memorial in Boston, a powerful one in the extreme because it gives the black troops that served in the Civil War a chance to be seen as individuals and not just mechanical figures. Favorite library? The Library of Congress. The Library of Congress is the greatest library in the world. Do you know what my favorite statistic is? There are still more public libraries in this country than Starbucks. Favorite movie that's based on a historical event? My favorite movies aren't of real events. Harvey with Jimmy Stewart and Some Like It Hot.
Pope Francis wraps up 2-day visit to Egypt with open-air mass by Nicole Winfield and Hamza Handawi. AP, Cairo. Pope Francis wrapped up a brief but deeply symbolic visit to Egypt on Saturday with an open-air mass for the country's tiny Catholic community, defying security concerns to show his support for the Christians of this Muslim-majority Arab nation who have increasingly become targeted by Islamic militants. Military helicopters flew overhead and police fanned out in force as Francis zoomed around the soccer stadium in suburban Cairo where mass was held. Using an open-topped golf cart and waving to members of the congregation, evidence of his hallmark desire to be close to his flock at all costs. The crowd cheered him wildly, waving Egyptian and Holy See flags and swaying to hymns sung by church choirs. The military-run stadium has a capacity of 25,000, but only about 15,000 people attended, a reflection that Catholics represent less than 1% of Egypt's 92 million people. But the relatively modest number and the draconian security did not dampen their jubilant mood. Francis engaged the crowd with waves and smiles and gave his blessings to the children hoisted up by their parents. In his homily, Francis urged them to be good and merciful to their fellow Egyptians, saying, "The only fanaticism believers can have is that of charity. Any other fanaticism does not come from God and is not pleasing to him," he said. It was a very pastoral message after Francis, on his first day, demanded that Muslim leaders renounce religious fanaticism that leads to violence. Francis made the appeal during a landmark visit to Cairo's Al-Azhar, the revered 1,000-year-old seat of Sunni Islam learning that trains clerics and scholars from around the world. Security was exceptionally tight around the stadium and in the upscale neighborhood where Francis spent the night, with uniformed and plain-clothed police stationed every meter, yard, or so along his motorcade route. Police used metal detectors to check vehicles for explosives, and armed guards stood watch, some on rooftops, their faces covered. But Francis decided to forego the bulletproof Popemobile his predecessors used on foreign trips and drove through Cairo in a simple Fiat, his window rolled down. "He is a messenger of peace, he is really a messenger of peace," said attendee Amgad Eskandar before the mass began at the stadium. "All his words talk about peace, call for peace, push for peace, which is great." The Pope's gestures, the simple fiat, and the open-topped golf cart sent a defiant message to the extremist Islamic State group, whose local affiliate in Egypt has vowed to target Egypt's Christians to punish them for their support of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. As defense minister in 2013, el-Sisi led the military's ouster of the Islamist Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first freely elected president whose one-year rule proved divisive. El-Sisi was elected president a year later and is widely expected to run for a second four-year term in office in June 2018. Already, attacks against Christians in northern Sinai, the epicenter of the insurgency, have forced scores of families to flee the region, seeking refuge elsewhere in Egypt. Recent attacks on churches, one in Cairo in December, and twin Palm Sunday attacks in cities north of the Egyptian capital, have claimed at least 75 lives and injured scores. IS claimed responsibility for the three attacks carried out by suicide bombers, as well as one earlier this month that targeted a police checkpoint near the famed St. Catherine's Monastery in central Sinai that killed a policeman. The attacks led to heightened security at churches nationwide and the declaration by el-Sisi of a state of emergency. Francis strongly backed the government's crackdown on the extremists Friday, saying Egypt was uniquely placed to bring peace to the region and vanquish all violence and terrorism. El-Sisi has since 2013 overseen a major crackdown against Islamists, jailing thousands along with hundreds of the activists behind the 2011 uprising that toppled autocrat Hosni Mubarak. El-Sisi's security forces, meanwhile, have been fighting in the Sinai Peninsula to put down an insurgency by militants led by the local IS affiliate. The militants have occasionally struck in mainland Egypt, targeting military and police personnel as well as government officials. El-Sisi has vowed to crush the militants while urging Muslim clerics to modernize Islam's religious discourse to stifle the culture of hatred for non-Muslims and the West embraced by jihadist militants. Francis also paid tribute to the victims of the December bombing at Central Cairo's St. Peter's Church, which is located in close proximity to the St. Mark's Cathedral, the seat of the Coptic Orthodox Church. Blood on one of the church walls remains unwashed and is adorned by pictures of the 30, mostly women, victims of that attack. His visit drew praise from Egyptian Catholics who haven't seen a pope in their land since St. John Paul II visited in 2000. I think he is a man of peace, and I think he will be like John Paul II. He will be a saint, said Mariam Fayak from the stadium grounds. While Francis came to comfort the Christian community after the recent spate of attacks, he also had some tough love for his local preachers. In a meeting with priests and seminarians, Francis urged them to stop complaining about all the troubles they face and lead their flocks with hope and dedication. Although there are many reasons to be discouraged, amid many prophets of destruction and condemnation, and so many negative and despairing voices, may you be a positive force. May you be sowers of hope, builders of bridges, and agents of dialogue and harmony. Thousands protest President Trump's climate policies on his 100th day in office. By Gene Johnson, AP, Washington. Thousands of people across the U.S. marched Saturday on President Donald Trump's 100th day in office to demand action on climate change. At the marquee event, the People's Climate March in Washington, D.C., tens of thousands of demonstrators made their way down Pennsylvania Avenue in sweltering heat on their way to encircle the White House. Organizers said about 300 sister marches or rallies were being held around the country, including in Seattle, Boston, and San Francisco. In Chicago, marchers headed from the city's Federal Plaza to Trump Tower. "We are here because there is no Planet B," the Reverend Mariama White Hammond of Bethel AME Church told the crowd in Boston. Participants said they're objecting to Trump's rollback of restrictions on mining, oil drilling, and greenhouse gas emissions at coal-fired power plants, among other things. Trump has called climate change a hoax, disputing the overwhelming consensus of scientists that the world is warming and that man-made carbon emissions are primarily to blame. More than 2,000 people gathered at the Maine State House in Augusta. Speakers included a lobsterman, a solar company owner, and members of the Penobscot Nation tribe. "I've seen firsthand the impacts of climate change to not only the Gulf of Maine, but also to our evolving fisheries and to the coastal communities that depend upon them," said lobsterman Richard Nelson of Friendship, Maine. People in the crowd spoke about the importance of addressing climate change to industries such as renewable energy, forestry, farming, and seafood. Saharla Farah, a 16-year-old immigrant from Somalia who lives in Portland, talked about how climate change could have a bigger toll on marginalized groups that have less financial resources. "But I see untapped power here today," she said. A demonstration stretched for several blocks in downtown Tampa, Florida, where marchers said they were concerned about the threat rising seas posed to the city. People gathered on Boston Common carried signs with slogans such as "Dump Trump." Handmade signs at Seattle's march included the general "Love Life" and the specific "Don't Kill Otters." Some of the marches drew big-name attendees, including former Vice President Al Gore and actor Leonardo DiCaprio in the nation's capital, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders at a Montpelier event. "Honored to join indigenous leaders and native peoples as they fight for climate justice," DiCaprio tweeted. President Trump says he brought profound change to Washington in first 100 days. By Jill Colvin and Paul Weissman, AP, Washington. President Donald Trump on Saturday marked his 100th day in office by saying he had brought profound change to Washington and reaffirming that "my only allegiance is to those he governs." During an evening trip to Pennsylvania, one of the states that propelled his unlikely election victory, Trump planned to sign an executive order directing the Commerce Department and the U.S. Trade Representative to conduct a study of U.S. trade agreements. "The goal is to determine whether America is being treated fairly by its trading partners and the 164-nation World Trade Organization." Trump was scheduled to visit the Ames Tool Factory in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, which has manufactured shovels since 1774, and then hold a campaign-style rally in Harrisburg, the state capital. Trump announced this past week that he intended to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement and begin reworking a trade deal with South Korea, with which the U.S. has a significant trade deficit. There isn't a day that goes by that the president doesn't discuss some aspect of trade, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said at the White House Friday. Early on in his tenure, Trump used an executive order to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal negotiated by the Obama administration. From the first day of my administration, I have governed by a simple idea. My only allegiance is to you, our wonderful citizens, Trump said in his weekly radio and internet address. Together, we are seeing that great achievements are possible when we put American people first. That is why I withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That day was a turning point for our nation. It put the countries of this world on notice that the sellout of the American worker was over. He said in his remarks, "In just 14 weeks, my administration has brought profound change to Washington." Executive orders in line to be signed Saturday would be the 31st and 32nd since taking office, the most of any president in his first 100 days since World War II. During the campaign, Trump railed against President Barack Obama's use of the power, which has the benefit of not needing congressional approval. The more significant of the two orders would give the Commerce Department and the U.S. Trade Representative 180 days to identify violations and abuses under U.S. trade agreements and recommend solutions. Ross said the WTO, the arbiter of world trade rules, was bureaucratic and outdated and needed an overhaul. Ross played down the possibility that the United States would consider leaving the organization, but didn't rule it out. The administration argues that unfair competition with China and other trade partners has wiped out millions of U.S. factory jobs. Ross said dissatisfaction with trade policy is one reason voters turned to Trump. Trump has ordered the Commerce Department to study the causes of the United States' massive trade deficit in goods, $734 billion last year, $347 billion with China alone. The administration is also imposing duties on Canadian softwood timber and is investigating whether steel and aluminum imports pose a severe threat to national security.
Ayesha Curry doesn't want to be a celebrity chef, by Katie Steinmetz. Ayesha Curry, outspoken Christian, mom, and sous vide enthusiast, is about to embark on the second season of her cooking show as her husband Steph Curry prepares for the second round of the NBA playoffs. Before Ayesha's home kitchen returns on April 30th, Time spoke to Curry about making religion part of her brand, what she sees as the most overrated food, hint it has a magical horn, and whether her relationship is as wholesome as it seems. In a world with a lot of cooking shows, how do you set yours apart? This season I wanted to share more recipes and have more fun with food. So for every recipe, we do about 5 dishes, and there's always a hack to make people's lives easier. I want people to feel like food doesn't have to be fussy, and you can entertain while you're cooking. So I always have somebody in the kitchen with me, whether it's a family member or a friend, and we just have an absolute blast. Why is there so much appetite for celebrity chefs and cooking shows? I have no idea. For me personally, it's always been a dream of mine and something I've been working towards, but I'd rather nobody think of me as a celebrity chef. I'm just a mom trying to get stuff done, and that's my whole thing. I just want to make food fun and approachable, though I actually know what I'm doing because I do have some training. It seems that whether you like it or not, some people will think of you as a celebrity. One of the best and worst things about being able to command public attention with a single tweet, whether it's about women's fashion or how the NBA is run. For me, I take it all with a grain of salt. I don't worry too much about the backlash, and I stand behind everything I do. It's also really cool at the same time to be able to have a platform where people somehow want to listen. And I've been lucky enough to be able to use my platform to do what I love. You've been critical of President Trump's proposed budget cuts for kids' food programs. Do you worry about weighing in on politics in such a tense climate?
There's always a line, but if you feel passionately about something, that's one of our First Amendment rights, right? Freedom of speech. You've got to read everything so you can form your own opinion. That's where I am now, always learning, always reading, always trying to figure out what I believe. What do you think is the most overrated, trendy food right now? The whole unicorn thing. All we're doing is putting food dye into everything, and I just wonder what our intestines look like at this point. Does it look like a rainbow of fun? And the most underrated? Sous vide, especially with how many at-home sous vide machines there are on the market that are actually affordable. I feel like it's such an innovative, cool way of cooking. Perfect steaks, perfect everything, and meal kit services. I started my own, and I'm sure everyone is like, oh, we've seen this before, but mine is different because it caters to families. Your brand is very family-focused and also outwardly about faith and religion. What do you find most challenging about mixing religion and your role as a public figure? I'm a Christian, and people are very misinformed on what Christianity is. They expect these certain things out of me, like, oh my God, she has a glass of wine. I'm not ashamed of my faith at all. I'm proud to put it out there, but I'm never pushing anything on anybody. That's never been the message, to push my beliefs. But it's a huge part of who I am, and I'm proud of it. So whenever I get the chance to talk about it, I do. Many of your fans are millennials who are much less religious than older generations. Fewer believe in God. Why do you think we're seeing that trend in America? Maybe it's how much access everybody has to everything, and everybody's preoccupied. We're in a time where pop culture has, unfortunately, become people's religion at times. It's a scary thing. I feel like morals have lessened. But as long as my family is doing what I feel is right, that's fine. I'm not going to judge anybody on what they feel is right. That's not what it's about. There's a perception of you and Steph being a couple that's more wholesome than the stereotypes you hear about famous male athletes, that you're bucking a trend. The truth about that is that we are different. We're not the norm. And that's fine. I don't think that's something that needs to be blasted out to the media. That just is what it is. Even our friends tell us that who are in the industry. We're everybody's little sister. We're everybody's little brother. And we're fine with that. We are open about our faith, but we're homebodies. HDTV, a glass of wine, and our kids makes us truly happy. We really enjoy each other's company, so our togetherness has kept us going. Does fame and celebrity ever cause tension for you two as a couple or a family? No, because behind closed doors, we don't talk about it. We don't look at it. We don't think about it. We're just completely normal when we're in our home and when we're with our family. It just happens to be part of life. I do wish we could go to Target as a family, but that's about it. For Americans, eating healthy and maintaining a healthy weight are popular topics. What do you think people can do to eat better? It's remembering everything in moderation. People get on these diet fads and then they rebound and then end up spiraling into deeper, more complex, worse eating habits. When you have a craving, fill that craving, but don't have a whole box of Krispy Kremes. That's been a part of my journey, remembering portion control. I've actually lost 17 pounds since January 1st, so I've been really happy. I finally got the rest of that baby weight off. But it's been a journey, and I did it very slowly. I was looking for a lifestyle change, and I think that's important for people to remember. So, just limit how many Starbucks unicorn drinks you have each day? Exactly. This interview has been condensed and edited for clarity. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.